Hi, I'm Jim Lewis. Thanks for coming to CSIS today. We're fortunate to have Vice Admiral Barry McCullough, who is the commander of the U.S. Fleet Cyber Command and the commander of the reestablished 10th Fleet. Now, the 10th Fleet in some way is a good precedent here because they, of course, were the fleet that fought the Battle of the Atlantic. And when you think about the Battle of the Atlantic, there's some interesting parallels there with cyber conflict, cyber warfare. What we do in cyberspace. Vice Admiral McCullough has had, as you'd expect, a long and distinguished career, beginning with nuclear engineering. So impressive fellow. I won't read you all of his commands, which include everything from frigates to, I guess, destroyers to carrier battle groups. So he's done the gamut, and it's in your handout there. What I would like to do, though, is turn it over to him. I think what we'll do is we'll let the Vice Admiral speak and then take questions at the end if he has a little time. So with that, Vice Admiral McCullough.
Well, first, it's good to be here with you this afternoon. CNO asked me to do this job about 8 months ago. And I was the N8, which is a head programmer and budget sort of guru for the entire Navy. And I think I'd have done most anything after doing that for 26 months, including being the dog catcher in Rio de Janeiro. But he asked me to do this, and I said, good, I'm out of the building, I'm out of the E-ring, and 4.5 years in the Pentagon, and any one fell swoop's enough. And then I went to Fort Meade and found out how much work there was to be done in this area. And so I'm not sure whether I jump from the fire into the frying pan or vice versa, but there's a lot of work to be done in networks, network security, electronic warfare, signals intelligence, information operations in space. And that's sort of what the boss laid out and the Secretary of the Navy approved and the DepSecDef approved where we were headed with this. I have some charts. I've given this brief to the CNO, Admiral Roughhead. I've shared it with the folks at the Naval Advisory Board from MITRE. I've given it to my subordinate commanders. And it just sort of outlines what we got asked to do and what we've done initially to try to get our arms around a problem and some of the places I think we ought to go. Now, this brief is predominantly focused on NIPRNet and CIPRNet networks, and it's because it's how we see to our forces at the operational level of war. So that's where our command and control rides. You know, when you talk about war fighting and you talk about operations at the tactical level, you're talking about data links like Link 16, Link 11, JTIDS, Tattle Alpha, et cetera. But when we do command and control at the operational level of war, it's done on computer networks. And it's real important to understand what the transport is and what the capacity is when you start dealing with this. It's also important to understand how you frame the operational picture. I'm a nuclear engineer, like the introduction said, so I love line diagrams, and I like to know where things are and what they look like and how they work. I'm also an air defense guy. And so I like things defined in battle space. And I'll call it battle space even though it's a domain, but that's how I talk about it. And so I have some slides on how I've started to talk about this to people in multiple government agencies as well as in the Navy and in the other services. And so I'll share a little bit of that with you. This set of charts outlines a set of problems. And somebody in the back of the room laughed, said, Barry, you got this all figured out. I said, yep, 2 months on the job. I got it scoped and taken care of. Move on to the next challenge. I think we've begun to get our arms around the problem set. And anybody that thinks there's a quick technical fix to this particular issue is sadly mistaken. So CNO asked us to do some work. And so he said that that the Fleet Cybercom Commander was going to be an Echelon 2 commander, and it was going to be the Navy component commander for U.S. Cybercom when U.S. Cybercom was established. Now, we started work on this back last summer, and we didn't know when CyberComm was going to be established, and so we initially had an OpCon relationship with CyberComm. If you read the newspapers and you listen to the data, we think that General Alexander's confirmation hearing will happen sometime this month, and then his confirmation will happen thereafter. But that said, we still have a need inside the Navy for Navy Fleet CyberComm, and so we established that relationship. So right now I'd be COCOM to Strategic Command. And I would operate COCOM to Strategic Command through the consolidated staff at Fort Meade. I also have a service cryptographic component relationship with the National Security Agency, which gives us our SIGIN authority under Title 50. And that becomes important when you start talking about what titles and authorities are granted to what officers. And as a Fleet CyberComm Commander, I have both Title 50 and Title 10 authority, which is important. I said I was an Echelon 2, so you can see that we're administratively controlled to the Chief of Naval Operations, as are his other Ash 2 commanders that are listed off on the left, Naval Special Warfare, Nav South, Nav Cent, Nav Ur, Nav Africa, which is really dual-headed with Naval Forces Europe, PAC Fleet, and U.S. Fleet Forces Command. Now, if you look at the commands that are subordinate to Fleet CyberComm as an Esh-2 and in my 10th Fleet hat as an Esh-3 operational commander, we have Navy Computer Defense Operations Center, NCDOC, which does our network defense. Navy Net Warcom, that's now a 3-star officer, that when Admiral Starling retires will be a 2-star officer. And they're responsible for the Navy computer telecommunication master stations in Norfolk and in Waiwa in Hawaii, so NICTAM's land, NICTAM PAC. And they're also responsible for NAV space operationally. And so the operations piece of that goes to Navy Net Warcom, and you could envision that he'd be responsible for operating networks. The Naval Information Operations Commands, the NIOCs, I organized into task forces, and I'll show you that in a subsequent slide. And I broke out NIOC-Suitland separate from that because NIOC-Suitland is really not aligned either globally with an NSA regional office or with a numbered fleet. They do have global responsibility in R&D, so you'll see that. And then we have a new type commander that's similar to the submarine forces commander, the air forces commander, surf forces commander, and we're going to call him Cyber 4. And he's responsible for Title 10 man train and equip of units. And the way I would liken his responsibilities is when I talked to Vice Admiral Tom Kilcline, that's commander of the Naval Air Forces, I said, Killer, how much time do you spend worrying about configuration control and networks on your aircraft carriers and then your air wings? And he looked at me and said, yeah. And I said, okay. How much time do you worry about their training and certification? I get the same answer. And it's not that Tom Kilcline is not interested in doing that. It's the spectrum of his responsibility, and when he's worried about manning, training, and equipping nuclear-powered aircraft carriers, certifying them for power plant operations, and certifying the flight deck and its equipment to launch and recover airplanes, he's got some big-time worries. And when we put networks in ships, I'll be honest with you, when we built the networks, it was sort of like, wow, this is really neat stuff, and we just sort of built them. And it was no rhyme or reason. There wasn't any build a little, test a little, learn a lot. It was we just built these things. And so what I'd have proposed to the platform type commanders is they give their responsibilities for man training and equip for networks, configuration control, control of ship alterations, et cetera, to NAV Cyber 4 as a type commander for cyber forces. And it's like a lot of this, you know, we're starting this up, and I'd tell you none of it's 100% right. But you got to start somewhere, and this is where we started. Okay, so CNO wrote us a letter because he can do this, and he told us to do what's in the guidance. Central Operational Authority for Networks, Cryptology, and Signals Intelligence, IO, Cyber, Electronic Warfare, and Space in support of forces afloat and ashore. Now, some of those are overlapping things. Information operations encompasses EW, cyber, and some other things, but this is the way the letter was written. So he made us the central operating authority for all these things. And that's quite a laundry list of things to be responsible for. He made us a Navy component commander to U.S. CyberCom. I talked about that. And then he made us a service cryptologic component commander to the National Security Agency, the Central Security Service, which gives us our Title 50 authority. So this is what he told us in a letter, and that's the guidance that I received. The letter was one page, you know, and it had more words on it than this, but this is sort of what it told me to go off and do. And I said, okay, how are we going to do this? So the staff came up with some initial lines of operation, if you will, and they're not lines of operation that you'd see in a kinetic commander's portfolio, but it's how we started to think about this. And what I tell you, the first line of operation, you can read the words, but what it means is dynamic network operations and dynamic network defense. And then when you read the middle one, achieve and sustain the ability to navigate and maneuver, I tell you that's exploitation. That's going out and gathering intelligence and looking what the other guy's doing in his battle space. And then on command and in coordination with these commanders, conduct ops. I'll tell you that's non-kinetic effects. And so if a regional combatant commander has an O plan or a con plan in support of his Navy component, the Fleet Cyber Command at 10th Fleet should be able to generate non-kinetic effects to support his operational timeline. And some people call it network attack. It's non-kinetic effect. You can have kinetic effects, bombs, missiles. You can have non-kinetic effects. And this is a non-kinetic effect. And then we looked at how we were going to try to do this. And it was a big problem. And we'd never aligned the global naval information ops commands and centers under a single officer. They were sort of lined up with the regional folks. And they're in every time zone in the world, pretty much. So I figured it was best for me to go travel around and see these places. And that, and I hadn't been on travel in 4.5 years working in the program and the resource business, and I thought it was good to get reacquainted with the rest of the world. Not really. I believe if you're a commander and you're standing up a new command, that you can talk to people through VTCs. And yeah, I got it. You never get a better assessment than to sit down with a subordinate across the table and go eyeball to eyeball with him and ask him where he stands on his mission, what his resourcing is, both people and dollars, what his current capability against his demands are and what his capacity is, and then what the physical state of his equipment is. And I'll talk a little bit about this, but I go to the signals analysis lab in Misawa, which is up at the northern end of Honshu in Japan. And they've got a blue tarp. I thought I was in a damage control training arena. And they've got a blue tarp over electronic equipment. Well, what in the world is up with this? Boss, the roof leaks, and we get 10 to 20 feet of snow here a year. And so I got a tarp over the equipment. Okay, so that told me something. I asked about the status of servers and what the routers are and what the replacements are and what's the material condition at some of our sites overseas, and I wasn't real happy with the answer I had. Stuff was obsolete. They were building, repairing the equipment through hangar queens, which in aviation vernacular means there's a jet down in the hangar bay. You pull parts of them, off of them when you don't have them to keep the ones that are operational flying. So you've got to go see those things, and you can find a lot out in a PowerPoint brief or through a video teleconference. But people will say the damnedest things to you when you ask them questions. And, you know, it's when I was CEO of a ship, I'd walk around and I told my department heads, I said, I'm going to find stuff out that you don't know. And, well, you're the captain. We're supposed to come tell you. Yeah, right. But you guys have got day jobs. I don't. And I have the time to walk around as a commander and talk to the lower level watch in the forward engine room and say, hey, how's it going? And you'd be surprised when they say, sir, you know that valve back there? We can't get to it to preserve it because it's up under the. And, okay, well, nobody told you that before, so now you know you got a problem. So I think getting out and looking at the folks is important. Defining the battle space, where is the equipment, what does it do, who owns the bandwidth, who owns the infrastructure, is it riding on commercial, is it riding on government, is it riding on Navy, what's it riding on? Shift the culture to an operational framework. We historically have not thought about operations in cyberspace, so on the networks, in an operational manner. And what do I mean by that? Okay, you need real-time situational awareness to see what's going on. And how do you display it, and what sensors do you have? And then there's going to be just a whole bunch of information. And so how do you call that with other tactical decision aids or programs so a human being can understand? And we were managing the network on a gripe chip mentality. And to an aviator, a gripe chip mentality means you land the airplane either on a carrier or a landing strip when you come home from a mission, fill out what's wrong with the airplane, give it to the crew chief, and he'll fix the airplane before it goes on its next hop. And so we were very reactive. We weren't proactive, and I'll tell you, you got to be predictive if you're really going to do this. And so we're reactive and static and not proactive, dynamic, and predictive. And how do you get there? And the other thing I'll tell you is we don't understand what normal is. And, for example, when I went in the Arabian Gulf in 2004 on Kennedy, we could tell you what the commercial traffic up the north end and the eastern end of the Arabian Gulf looked like. That's where all the commercial tankers go because that's where the channel is. But if you started talking about small commercial traffic, fishing vessels, oil rig or oil platform service vessels and recreational vessels that were in and around the infrastructure in that body of water, we had no idea what normal was. Now, how many years had we spent there since 2004? About 54 years. We started going over there in 1950. And we knew what normal was one place. We didn't know what it was the other place. We had no idea what it is here. Okay, so typical Navy guy, how am I going to do this? Well, I took down the forces, looked at the forces that we had, and the staff came up with a task force organization, which is the way we do things in the Navy. And so you see the 10th Fleet Commander and the Deputy Commander off. That's a headquarters. And then I named the task forces in a 1,000 series, so 10, 10, 10, 20, 10, 30. We were going to name them in hundreds, so 10 was the first number, and, you know, and that looked really neat. And then we found out Mount Whitney was Task Force 106 for something, and so we couldn't do that, so we had to use thousands. So we're using 10 and numbers after 10. So Task Force 1010 is Navy Net Warcom, so there are operational folks. And then Task Force 1020 is Navy Computer Defense Operations Center in Norfolk, so they do network operations and network defense. If you go up into the purple box in the top, this is where we provide manning and resources, predominantly manning, to support our national mission for the National Security Agency. And so we have, if you go to the National Security Agency site in Misawa, it's got sailors, it's got airmen, it's got Marines, it's got soldiers. This is the Navy's contribution to that. And so you can see the one at Menmuth Hill Station in the U.K., the one in Misawa that I spoke to. There's one in Augusta, Georgia. I probably ought to go visit them this week so I could go see the golf game. What I'm really going to do is I'm going to go to Pearl Harbor for Terminal Fury so I can go see the guys in Hawaii again. Yakima's in eastern Washington. We have a great electronic warfare test range out there, but they also do national mission. Sugar Grove in West Virginia, San Antonio, Texas, Maryland, which is right across the street from me. Near Fort Meade, Colorado, which does all things space for us, well, most things space for us, and then Alice Springs down in the center of Australia. Then I've also organized the NIOCs, which some of them are the same fellows that are in the purple box up here, or ladies, and they're the Fleet Operation Information Commands. And I won't read them all to you again, but there's some additional ones there. There's some folks in Bahrain and some other places. And so you can see that 1040 is in Texas. So he's aligned with 4th Fleet that supports Southern Command. 1050 is in Georgia. He's aligned with 5th Fleet. 1060 is in Maryland, and he's in Maryland because he's predominantly Europe and the Eurasian northern continent. Hawaii, you can imagine what he's lined up with, but he's 1070 because he's aligned with his 7th Fleet. And then 1080 is Colorado. He's global. And I put him there because he's a FIOC, and so we put him there. Then if you look at the people that are specifically working on information operations, They're under the 1030 hat that's let out in Norfolk, but also has people in San Diego and Whidbey Island. And that's a gorgeous place to go if you've never been there. R&D's 1090, and that's Suitland, and I spoke to that a little earlier. So I said, okay, we have this job to do, and on the 29th of January, we put out an op order that laid our organization out like this. Okay, we've got all these challenges. This is how we're going to build the organization to start. And again, is it right? I don't know. It's much better than what we've had in the past because all these folks are aligned under a single S2 commander. Okay, so then I told you I went around the world, and I did go around the world. In January, before we did the stand-up, I went to Athens, and I went out to Pearl Harbor. In Athens, I saw the folks at NIOC, Georgia, and in Pearl, I saw the folks at NIOC, Kenia, in Pacific, as well as the PAC Fleet Commander. I met him out there. Then on the 31st of January, right after we stood up the command, we flew to Italy and landed in Rome and drove down to Naples and saw the 6th Fleet Commander, the telecommunications stations folks in Naples, and we saw the Navy European Commander, so the Navy Component Commander for Europe, and when we were in PAC, obviously, and we saw PAC Fleet, he was the Component Commander for PACOM. Then we flew to UK, up to Manchester, and drove out to Menwith Hill and stayed there for a day. And I looked at what they were doing, pretty impressive operation. Then we flew down to Bahrain and saw the Navy telecommunications station in Bahrain as well as the FIOC in Bahrain. I met with the 5th Fleet Commander. That's also the component commander for U.S. Central Command. Then we have our airplanes that are supporting operations in theater. Specifically, the EP-3s are down in Al-Udeid and Gutter. So we took a little sidebar down to Al-Udeid and went and talked to our folks there. Then we left there and flew to Tokyo via Hong Kong. I'm sorry. We went to the Navy Telecommunications Station in Yokosuka, and we went to the FIOC in Yokosuka. And then we took 737 right up to Misawa. And saw the folks up there, and I had the most terrifying commercial airplane ride coming out of that place that I've ever had in my life. Okay, so the Air Force, this is a dual Air Force, Japanese Self-Defense Force Air Force base, and they get four commercial flights a day, four in, four out. And the weather's really blustery, and it's really nice day for somebody. And the airplanes are running an airspace control exercise from Angels 3, so from 3,000 feet up to somewhere, centered on Misawa. And so we take off in the 737, and you think they'd have cleared us through the controlled airspace, not on your life. And that pilot rolled that 737 out at about 2,500 feet, and I thought it was dropping, so I told the aide, we're going to buy it, we're done. And it was yawing, pitching, and rolling, and heaving, and doing all kind of things that I don't like unless it's coupled to the surface of the world. Ships do it, I'm fine with it. And so finally we got out of there. But it was a really interesting airplane ride. Next day we flew back to Texas, went to San Antonio, and saw the place in Texas and came home. And that was when you all had the 30 inches of snow. I was in Bahrain with it being 68 degrees or 72 degrees. And when you had the subsequent 12 or 14 inches of snow or whatever it was, I think I was flying from Japan to Texas. So can you imagine when I showed up on the 12th of February how happy my wife was to see me? Yeah, that was fun. So we stayed home for a week, and then we went to the West Coast, and we did Whidbey, stopped in and saw Microsoft in Redmond. Went down to Colorado and saw folks in Colorado, went to San Diego and came home. And so that's pretty much how I spent February. And we're getting ready to go back to Pearl Harbor on Saturday to do Terminal Fury. So a lot of rides in airplanes. But again, I think it's hugely important if you're going to have a global command like this, you've got to go see your commanders and you've got to see what's on the ground. So what did I find out? And this is my anecdotal information from flying around the world. Everybody's doing really great things. And as you can imagine, having these organizations grow up in a regional construct, not one of them was doing it the same way. Now, that's not to say they should do, every one of them should do 100% the same thing, because they'll have differences based on their regional tasking. But I will tell you, 80 to 85% of their processes, procedures, and techniques should probably be the same. And the standards ought to be set, and everybody ought to meet minimum standards. Oh, by the way, we don't do inspections. And, you know, Rickover said you get what you inspect, not what you expect. And we don't do any of the inspecting type things. So we found that out. Cross-domain balance of capability and capacity. I talked about the organizations that do both national mission and service mission. Okay, if they're manned to 115%, that's not a big deal. You can do it all, maybe, if you got the right number of people for the mission you've been given. But if you've only got 75% of your manning, where don't you do what you've been tasked to do? And so this is a balance issue with capability and capacity. Some of the folks, some of the regions are staffed with younger folks. When I went, I was usually briefed by E5s and E6s or chiefs. And in a couple of the places, I was briefed by E3s and E4s, not because they wanted the E3s and E4s to brief the 09. That was who was doing the work. So we're looking into that. And so what do we have there? I talked a little bit about plant property equipment and capacity issues. Capacity is really, we're building a new building in Hawaii to take over the business in Hawaii. And as you can imagine, it's not big enough. So now we didn't get all the way out of Kenea. We've got to maintain Kenea. And there's another place that's got a similar issue. Systems and lifecycle management. I said we built these things because we needed this capability. And we didn't look at when do you replace it, what's the right time to replace it. So we've got some things that are probably older than they should be and don't work as well as they should be or should do. And so we've got to get our hands around that. Operational standards and assessments. Now, nothing I say here should be construed that I'm attacking the people that went before me, because without the effort that they put forth, so the Dick Mayos and the Jimmy MacArthurs and the Denby Starlings, if they hadn't have done their jobs and exceeded what anybody expected of them, we wouldn't be in a position to make this move, the move we made with 10th Fleet and Net War Command and the OPNAV staff with the N2-N6 realignment. But we have not defined what our operational standards are. And I also don't intend to criticize any other government agencies. So when I say something, I'm not criticizing somebody. It's just the way I believe. So I come into this job, and I find out the Defense Information Systems Agency is doing inspections on service networks. Well, first I ask, what's the authority lash up? Well, there is one. But why do we have a combat support agency in the U.S. federal government doing certification systems inspections on service systems? It's because we didn't do it. Somebody had to do it. So I would tell you we need to understand what the standards are at a minimum. And if the services have got higher standards in place in different parts of the overall assessment, we should use those service standards. And then we should inspect ourselves like the Nuclear Propulsion Examining Board does with nuclear-powered warships, something called an Operational Reactor Safeguards Examination. And then we ought to turn to DISA and say we're certifying ourselves. And so we're working on that. I've talked to the commander at DISA, and I think we're of like mind in this. But again, how much capacity do we have to do this to ourselves, and what is the right periodicity? And so I don't know whether the right periodicity is every year, every 2 years, every 18 months, in accordance with the Fleet Response Training Plan. I don't know what the periodicity is. I just know it needs to be done. So we're going to do that. Correct balance of seniority, I've talked about. Priority languages. Defense Department has six priority languages for the Defense Language Institute, and I'll miss one of them. I've been memorizing this and getting pretty good at it. But. Okay, you've got Mandarin Chinese. You've got Spanish. You've got Russian. You've got Arabic, Farsi, Korean. I missed one. Okay, so there are the six basic languages, and if you're going to be a linguist, you've got to take one of these courses. So I'm down in LUD, and I'm talking to this young blonde fellow in the back of an airplane. And I said, well, what's your language? And he goes, well, Pashto. And I said, well, why Pashto? And he said, Admiral, if you want to kill terrorists, you got to understand Pashto, and I want to kill terrorists. Boom. And I said, man after my own heart. Okay. So I came back and started asking questions. And how do you do this? And how do you get those guys the language proficiency pay, and what's the right number, and how do you get them Navy enlisted classification codes so they can get SR selective reenlistment bonuses, and we can take care of these kids? And what's the right number? Okay, do we need 1,000 of them? I don't think so. Do we need 50 of them? I don't know whether that's the right number. Something tells me that's a little light. But what's the right number? And, you know, when we started this 9 years ago, we didn't have a lot of past due linguists because we didn't go there. Now we're there. We've been there for 9 years, and most of the past due linguists, I know the ones we have in the Navy, are contractors. And that's not to say contractors are bad folks, but I don't have enough to put in the back of the EP3s. And so what's the right number? That's what we're working on, and there's some other things we need to work on too. And then what's the correct career path for critical skill sets? If you train an officer or enlisted to work in a network, so you get these people trained and experienced enough that they can do online operations in a network, and then you take them out of it 2 years to send them to sea, you've just wasted all that money and time because they are not proficient when they come home. Now, you see this? This is a surface warfare pen. I spent my whole life going to sea. And until 6 months ago, I'd have told you that everybody in the Navy should go to sea. Now I'll tell you, where you stand depends on where you sit. And if we train these people and invest this money in these folks, we really got to rethink what we're doing. And it's the same thing for the officers. I mean, so do we have the right career paths? Have we got it right? And I'm not saying yes or no, and this is a little bit out of my lane, but it's what I saw. And so when I came home as an S2, I can talk to the OPNAV N1, the personnel guy, chief of Navy personnel. And I did. I said, hey, Mark, what's going on with this? So they're off looking at it. And I need to talk to the person that does requirements for the Navy in that regard, and that's Admiral Dorsett. So I called up Jack and said, Jack, you know, we got this issue. What are we going to do about it? So now I got the two people that are supposed to be able to fix this, not me, doing something about it. And maybe they'll come back and tell me it's not a problem. But it's what I saw. Okay, so based on what I saw, where's the change and the challenge? What's the global domain, and how do you make? I'm worried about the Navy. So how do I make Navy people understand that I'm really going to command and control their networks, and that capability and capacity is going to be there when they need it? You know, most regional guys want to own things, and if I was a regional guy, I'd probably want to own it. It's not the right way to do it. So this is a trust and confidence relationship that has to be built with my peers. And so that's another reason I went and saw them all. What are the command and control relationships? Are they supporting? Are they TACON, OPCON, COCOM? What are they? And I'll tell you, we don't know the answer to that. We set the organization up, and I showed you COCOM and OPCON. So we'll see. We're getting ready to go to PAC Fleet and do Terminal Fury, which is a certification exercise for the PAC Fleet staff. And right now, I've got an OPCON relationship with the consolidated staff at Fort Meade, and I'm tactical control to Admiral Walsh's in that capacity. So we're testing something out. And is it the right thing? I don't know. But we're going to test it out and see how it works. If we don't have assured C2, nothing else really matters. Do I think computer network attack is important? Yes. But if I can't command and control the network and defend the network and operate with the adversary inside the wire, the rest of it is just meaningless. We're going to lose. You know, and we've spent a lot of the nation's treasure developing really exquisite kinetic capabilities, best in the world by far. But if you can't command and control, you can't take advantage of that technical superiority. And we've got to be able to command and control. Definition and understanding of battle space, I'll get to in a little bit. Defining standards, I talked about that. I talked about the where the culture and training is, and it's not operationally focused. Cyber processes are dynamic, no news to any of you all. But you're never going to get to the 100% solution here. If you're lucky, you'll be running at the 85% solution. And where you are today, you might not be tomorrow. So if you think you have access and visibility to something that's going on, you might not have it tomorrow. Infrastructure fragility. You know, there's a lot of discussion in the press about satellites and the health of the satellite system. I tell you all to take that very seriously, and I know some of you all are from organizations that help us build that capability. But real issue and where we're going, unity of command and effort, I'm bringing the folks into the fold to get unity of command and effort. And resource and leadership efforts are divided. I'm not my own budget submitting office. And you can imagine is that coming from being the head resource dude in the United States Navy, I sort of want to be my own budget submitting office. So I've got control of my own money. That's something I learned. If you control the money, you got it. If you don't, yeah. So when I looked at what are the challenges to do this, we've got to position the Navy to lead in dynamic cyber operations. And if you look at dynamic cyber operations, it's dynamic network operations, it's dynamic network defense, it's dynamic exploitation, and it's dynamic development and non-kinetics. So we don't look at the network as a weapon system. We just don't. But if you use that to command and control your forces at the operational level of war, you better start looking at it that way. There's no composite situational awareness. I'll talk to that in a minute. There's limited tool set that we had inside the Navy or that we're aware of to do the things we want to do. I found a lot out since I built this chart. And I talked about static and reactive versus dynamic and proactive, and then predictive. We can't continue to rely on kinetic capability and capacity. It just puts us on the wrong side of the economic curve with future potential adversaries. And if you look at some of the real high-end weapons, and I'll let you think about it, I'd tell you if you had a high-end weapon and looked at something we developed to kill it kinetically, we could be on the wrong side of the economic curve by a factor of four. And so where are we going to get the money to do what we need to do and the capacity we need to do? So you got to get to the left side of the kill chain, and that's what this helps us to do. Now, the decision space, how do we do operationalization of cyberspace? And that's what, you know, ops and defense. How do we use it to gain intelligence? And then what are the appropriate investments, the investment strategy, and priorities? Now, everybody wants to tell me your toe is zero sum. So what's that mean? Well, that means whatever's in N2, N6 is total obligatory authority. That's, you can't get any more than that. Well, I don't believe that. I think it's a zero-sum game within the Navy's TOA. And then this has got to compete based on capability, capacity, and priority. And so we'll work that in the POM development. Dynamic cyber ops, a lot of these get into, when I give these briefs, it's to beat ideas into people's heads, not necessarily yours, but I didn't want to build a separate brief to come talk to you all. Again, define and promulgated standards, assessments, and follow-up. Okay, if you go do an assessment and command's all off the mark, what are you going to do? You got to do something about it. So what are the training processes to get the right information to the people? What are the technical things that need to be done when you go in and find the servers or the routers are all contaminated? So you got to be able to do that. I talked about command and control relationships are not really defined, and so we're starting to figure out how to try to define them. Situational awareness, definition and display. How do you define the battle space and how do you display it? I'm an Aegis guy, and if you've been on an Aegis cruiser, a captain and a tactical action officer sit up front. There's these four big screens that sort of give you the overall picture of what's going on in the world, or at least in your part of the world. And then if you go back, there's consoles. So you got Aegis display for the captain and the TAO. And then you go back and you have consoles for the operators, and they're called command and decision consoles. And they're the guys that are down in the details. You need the same thing for this. You know, who does this for a living? You saw I went and visited AT&T. And I'm sure there's one in Verizon, and I'm sure there's one in pick somebody else. So I'm not saying one internet service provider does it better than the other one. I'm just saying I went and saw the one at Bedminster. So it's $140 billion plus or minus corporation is what I've been told or what I read in the stock market pages. They've got less than 20 people running their ops floor. Oh, and half of it's telephony. So half of it's telephones. So now you got less than 10 people, if you got less than 20 doing the whole thing. You got less than 10 doing the network stuff. And they understand what the infrastructure looks like. They're predictive. They'd have to be, or they'd go out of business. So would Verizon. So would anybody. If you can't have dynamic SA, and you can't have predictive analysis to tell you what's going on with capacity or whatever, you would go out of business commercially. So we would be out of business because we don't have that. So that sort of bothered me. I talked about TDAs and pre-planned responses. Some things have to be done at machine speed, not everything. Some things have to be done in what I'll call near real time with human interface. You know, we've got issues and challenges with titles of the U.S. federal code. So you've got Title 50 issues, Title 14, law enforcement, and then what we can do under Title 10, and where's the information found, and who can know where you got it, or who can know what the information is, and who needs to know what when. And so these are things we need to work through. And then target folder development, how do you develop kinetic effects in support of a combatant commander or Navy component commander's requirements. Okay, so this is the way I started to explain this. Aircraft carrier, okay, got it. Aegis cruiser, got it. Aegis destroyer, they're all there. And so they're operating, and they're air defense folks. Okay, so here comes some bad guys from the outside, and I know what they look like. Okay, so in an air defense arena, the first ring you build is a surveillance area. And you don't control it, and you don't own it, because you don't have the capability and the capacity to do it. But you do have the capability and capacity to gain knowledge and intelligence of what's happening in a surveillance area. To me, that's a commercial grid. And so, okay, these are all the commercial ISPs, and they're out there doing what they're doing. We ought to know what's going on out there. We can't control it. We don't have the money. Industry and commercial controls the development of cyber capability capacity, not us. When somebody wants to buy an aircraft carrier, I know who controls the demand in that market. That's us. When you start talking about demand in cyber and internets and networks, it's not us, and we just got to get over that, and that's the way it is. And so we've got to have a say on what's going on in the surveillance area. Okay, well, who's inside of that? Well, in an air battle, it's intercept and escort area, which means if an airplane flies in there, I've got a track on it. Or I've got an escort with it, and I can pretty much tell what's going on, and I ought to be able to influence that because we own it. In an airspace, you own that airspace. It's usually inside at 200 miles in an air battle. Ours is global. So who is that? To me, that's DISA. What does the government own? What does the government lease? And what do we rent? And to me, there's a difference between lease and rent. Lease, I think, ensures that we have bandwidth. Rent is dynamic, and so might be more this month than next month. I don't know, but I'm trying to figure that out. But I think the folks at DISA probably know that, and I need to partner with DISA to get that display. And so, okay, here we are. Now we've got two rings of the pie. Okay, we've got national sensors that look at where the gateways are to the grid so we can see what's going on at that interface. And then I'll build what I call a vital area inside. That's what the Navy owns. And we ought to know everything about that. And I tell you, I don't have as much confidence as I should that we know a whole lot about that. Okay, so we've got that. Then we've got Navy sensors. And I don't know why these aren't building. But so you've got sensors between the DISA grid and the commercial grid. And we've got sensors between the Navy grid and the DISA grid. And then we've got volume sensors that ride on the Navy grid. And I'm sure DISA has something similar. And so how do you take those things and build the Aegis display system for networks? And that's sort of what I saw in Bedminster. Okay. Now, I'd also tell you that there's a lot of shared infrastructure between different level security networks, and that's pretty well known. And so if you have a shared infrastructure, you ought to be aware of where the commercial grid is. And so if something happens, like a ship drags an anchor and takes out a commercial internet cable, you ought to know how that understands us. And we need some work in that area. You know, if a trawler cuts an undersea cable, you ought to understand how that impacts us. And we don't. Because if one of your regional guys loses his connectivity, you ought to know where to go to reroute it. And you ought to be able to talk to your next layer in this business, which would be DISA. DISA, we've got a problem. We just lost X, and it's important to Navy. Because in the scheme of things, it might not be as important to the DISA commander as it is to us. Now, that doesn't mean he's not working on it, but it might be a lot more important to us than it is to him. And so can we focus their efforts? Can they focus the commercial's efforts? And how do you mix and match all of this? And so this is the way I understood this. It doesn't mean it's for everybody, but this is the way I can talk to Navy operators about how we should do business. Now, this is a great chart. This is what I call the importance of normal. And it's some of the chart's hard to read. This is pretty much what normal is for a business day. And this is a telephony chart for capacity. And this provider showed me this chart, and he said, okay. He said, you can see that between 1900 and 2400, we were way over capacity. So if you know what normal is, you know you're over capacity. And so what's important, a 25% deviation, a 10% deviation? I don't know. But they knew they were over capacity, and they also were predictive because they had predictive analysis, and they knew this was American Idol voting night. And that's what that is. So they understood the environment. They understood what normal was. There was a deviation, but it was an expected deviation, so they had the capacity available to deal with it, and they didn't panic because they knew it was coming. We don't have that. So that was a pretty neat thing they showed me. I talk about the 85% solution a lot. There's a lot of folks that do this for a living that are way smarter than I am that tell me if you just do your patches right and you just do your standard security practices right and obey the TTP, thumb drives, things like that, do what you're supposed to do that you can take out 85% of the threat. Okay? So if you can take out 85% of it, you can start to deal with the stuff down in the left that's hard. And you're not worried about policing out, you know, some college kid that just wants to be a hacker and is mucking around in a Navy.mil system. And there are people that will do that. But we really want to get rid of where we don't have to focus on that. And let's focus on the hard things. And, you know, when you got limited resources, and people used to say to me, well, geez, Barry, the Navy budget's $130-some billion. Yeah, but it's just not free money hanging out there to go use on something. And so if you've got limited resources and you need to commit your limited resources against priorities, you ought to do what you need to do with TTP's training and whatnot and get rid of the 85% of it and concentrate on the stuff that's important to you. And I said, okay, given that, what do we need to do soon? And I told the boss when he asked me about this, he said, Barry, when are you going to be able to do all this stuff? And I said, well, I think I can give you dynamic ops and defense by the summertime. And I told him that back, you know, I don't know, last fall when we were talking about this, but when he asked me to go up there. And I didn't know anything about what I was talking about. Still don't know much, but... Now I'm real glad it stays warm in Washington to past Halloween. So, streamlining reporting. You know, we're required to, our commands are required to submit reports. When I look at the reports my NIOC submit, I get things like Chief So-and-so was awarded a Navy and Marine Corps Commendation Medal. Well, I think that's important. And I'm glad Chief So-and-so, I don't need to know that. I mean, you know, if I go to the command and they want me to give the guy the medal, I'm very happy to do that. And I'm sure that Chief Petty Officer deserved that medal. But I don't need that in my weekly reports. I need to know what's going on operationally. And we're not focused that way. So we need to, I've got some ideas. You know, my initial thing was going to do it the way we did it in crewed as Navy. And you guys are going to submit a weekly report to me. And it's going to be in an op rep 1-5 format. And oops, that didn't work. So stop that. That's what I said. We're not going to do it all right. Go out and try some other stuff. Develop normal. Pursue deviations on predictable patterns, the chart I showed on the telephony. and figure out how to share the information with the regional commanders. Everybody that does this is going to have a different perspective on it. I tell you that Bill Gortney, sitting in Bahrain, is going to be real focused on what's going on with his networks that support his ops down off of the Horn of Africa, that support his ops up in Iraq and the things he's working on in Afghanistan. I'm sure he's real focused on that. I'm interested in that. But there might be something going on at PACOM that affects what Bill Gortney's doing in CENTCOM in this world. And so when he starts to have problems, we should be able to talk, and we can both see the same picture, and we can sort out what's going on, sort of like the ship dragging anchor thing. Consolidated staff and the regional commanders, let's get through to command and control and what's the right lash up. I'll tell you that we're going out there, and 10th Fleet, or Fleet Cyber Command, is going to be designated a Joint Cyber Operations Task Force Commander. Don't ask me what that is. I know it's a title we made up, and that's what I'm going to be. And I know where I support PACOM and where I support PAC Fleet, and it's in an OPCON-TACON relationship, but is it right? I talked about the standards, the platform, TICOMs, and ops level, and establish the assessments. A little bit about afloat cryptography and electronic warfare. We have direct support folks that ride on submarines and fly in airplanes and ride on surface ships. Surface ships are aircraft carriers, cruisers, whatever. And when I go places, I get told, well, we have X number on aircraft carrier. Okay. So what? Well, sir, X number on aircraft carrier. So what? What's the right number? And they look at you. I said, well, I know it's not zero, but it might not be 10. It might be 5. And so we got to get our arms around that. And there's ability we have to reach through our modern systems and doing this stuff remotely and do things remotely. And what, you know, what level's collected on what target for the regional commander? Our national assets collected on his top priority, and so he can focus his tactical assets on his number two priority. He has very little viz into what the national assets are doing. I can find out in about 15 nanoseconds. And so we need to work with the regionals on that. How we move information around that we collect from our various sensors is still pretty antiquated. I won't tell you it's ET phone home, but it's probably ET mail home. And you know, in a digital world and the way we live on a network, you ought to be able to do it a lot faster than that and take advantage of the wide variety of stuff you're collecting. And that's what I mean by the EW signature turn cycle. And so this is what we're working on in EW and SIGINT. So consolidated cryptologic collection plans. So we work with the regional guys to figure out how to apply the assets against the right targets. Focus the analysis. Collections driven by desired effects. Don't just be out there to be collecting. You know, I call that intelligence for intelligence sake. Doesn't do anything for you. And then I talked about demanding. Do we have it right, and what are we doing with it? So move from reactive to predictive. Effects-based offensive cyber requirements. Okay, here's a great one. You know, when we shoot a standard missile to Block 3B against an air target, I can tell you that X percent of the time, it's going to kill the target. And I can say that with pretty much certainty. When we drop a 500-pound JDAM, I can give you the probability of kill or desired effect out of a 500-pound JDAM. If you start to go down non-kinetic effects, how do you measure? What's a measure of effectiveness? What's a circular area of probability? And what's a P sub K? I mean, how are you going to define this? Because if I was John Byrd out in 7th Fleet, and John Byrd came to Barry McCullough and said, I want you to take down an air defense network somewhere. And I said, I can do that. Admiral Byrd's going to want to know before the jets show up that we took the air defense network down. And so, you know, is it this one penetration or one system or data flow or influence or somebody's confidence in their data? How many different ways do you have to go after that effect taking down an air defense network? to give him a reasonable piece of K like you could with a kinetic weapon. Because unless I can do that to him, if he doesn't have a TLAM strike plan to back that thing up, he wouldn't be where he is. Second and third order effects, how well do we know the network and what collaterals are we willing to live with? You know, if you start talking about generating non-kinetic effects and you need to take down a router box in some third country to generate an effect in a country you're after, what are you doing if that happens? And what's acceptable? And if you don't understand how the traffic patterns are and what flows through networks and what backups are, you're not going to be able to deliver this effect. The fragility, you can have the methodology and the capability to do it now. Oops, and you don't have it now. So how can you guarantee you maintain that capability? And then the integration of all assets to achieve the effects we need, EWIO in space. And so these are some of the things we're trying to work through. And so I said, okay, here's what we're going to try to do this year, and that's what I talked to the CNO about Halloween. And I might ask him if I can depend on Santa Claus to help. So we'll see. So these are what we want to do. And here's the long way ahead. You know, here's where we are. We're reactive. You need to move to proactive, and I want to be able to do that in ops and defense by October. Is that too high of a goal? Probably. But if you don't have a stretch goal, you're not going to get anything. Predictive and FY15 adaptive, I don't know. And these are some things that support what we meant by it, so we just didn't have an asymptotic graph with some stuff on it. Tried to put some what do you need to do to get there stuff behind it. And, you know, what? And then the other thing is expectation management. What can you really do? So develop achievable goals. You know, my thing is always develop achievable goals and over-execute. Don't over-promise and under-execute. It's your credibility is shot when you do that. Now, you can't so under-promise that you can do it next week and take the next 51 weeks off. So how do we build what we're trying to get to in the long run? And there's a lot of things that need to go on here. And I want to get to your question, so I won't spend a lot of time on this. But, so we tried to focus it on what do we need to do now? What do we need to do by the end of the year? And then what do we need to do based on the letter that the boss gave us? And with that, I'll take your questions.
Hey, that was pretty good. We got some questions out there?
Sure.
One in the front. Do you need me to do this? I'll sit here and bad interference.
Okay.
You made no mention of Marine Corps or Coast Guard mm-hmm. in your talk. Can you comment on your relationship with them?
Marine Corps. First, when we did thanks for the question, and I'm sorry I didn't dwell on any of that. I got asked, what will you define as your initial operational capability? So we picked a real-world event and said we need to be able to see to our capability to that level. And we promptly invited the Air Force, the Coast Guard, the Marine Corps, and the Army to send reps to our scenario generation and to our assessment of ourselves, our self-assessment, to say we could execute our mission. The commander of the 24th Air Force, Major General Rick Weber, and I served sentence in the Pentagon for a lot of the 4.5 years I was there. He just came and talked to the CNO's executive panel last Friday, and we called up and talked about what he was going to present and what I was going to present. The chief of staff for Terminal Fury is an Air Force One star officer out of the 24th Air Force. The deputy is a Marine Corps two-star general, Rooster Schmittel. The Deputy J-5 is an Army colonel. So we're all standing this business up pretty much simultaneously, and we all understand that there's not enough money in the world for any of us to go it alone. General Alexander's been pretty firm about that in his current bill as director of the National Security Agency. And so I think we're working this all pretty well together. And I think, you know, we're going to – the 24th Air Force guys have already said they're going to invite us to some of their exercises. We do things pretty much in conjunction with the Marine Corps, both when we build a program and then when we do our exercises. So we'll continue to work with Marfor Cyber. The Army's still working through this. They're using their Commander Air and Missile Defense Command, Army Air and Missile Defense Command right now as the officer I see in the meetings. I don't know where that will end up when the Army sorts through it all, so I don't want to speak for the Army, but he's been at the meetings, so we're all in this together, Norman, and we understand how important it is for the nation, at least our piece of it. Coast Guard participated in the assessment, and I can't tell you whether I'm taking any of those guys with me to Hawaii right now or not. I don't remember, but we're trying.
Thank you.
Sir?
Bill Sweetman, Defense Technology International magazine. Given that your systems are not connected to the internet, where a lot of people worrying about cybersecurity are concerned because they're out there in the jungle. What are the things that you worry about as routes by which, as you said, the bad guys are operating within your system?
We are connected to the commercial internet. And that's what that second ring between the intercept and escort area and the surveillance area is. So we're very worried about what happens out there. The physical connections are in the unclassified world. And then we make use of it in the classified world. And so, it's how do we garner information in the global internet to contribute to our situational awareness on what's going on in the network, because the bad actors are out there. I don't know whether that answers your question or not.
You talked about the nuclear Navy, mm-hmm. and in particular Admiral Rickover's admonition that you get what you inspect, not what you expect.
Correct.
NAVCO8 has one of the strongest inspection programs.
Mm-hmm.
There is. The rest of the DOD doesn't do anything like it.
Right.
What will it take? How much will it take to even get halfway there?
We should identify that Alan's a former Navy guy, so that's why.
Having lived through that punishment on multiple occasions on an annual basis, we started. The Navy has a couple of internal assessment teams that I'm trying to bring together now, because I've got an organization that does a piece of it and a different organization that does another piece of it, and then there's some other folks that think they ought to have a piece of it. So I've got to get my own house in order. We did some assessments for some upcoming exercises, so I launched an assessment team out to do it. So the first, and I've talked to Major General Weber and the Marine Corps Colonel Zotti, that's a day-to-day lead for the Marine Corps, about how I want to go with this, and asked them if they had anything similar for their services. And it was a lot of note-taking and nodding. And so, I can't sit here and say the Navy's got this right, because we don't. I'm trying to put it together. And I tell you, there was recognition for the two gentlemen I mentioned that this probably wasn't a bad idea. It's going to have to be up to the services. I believe that's a service responsibility. And I don't think any one service should dictate to the other one on how to do it. But I showed them the model that I was planning on using.
Hi, I'm Christine Smith from Army Cyberspace Task Force. The good news is our XORD is coming out in the next couple of weeks. Two related questions, manning and training. Number one, training. We've found through several studies that I've been working on at the DOD level that while there's a lot of talk about training for the military side, that there hasn't been a lot of focus on the civilian and contractor side. How is Navy responding to that call, for that need? And also, is Navy planning on creating a new MOS or dealing with that sort of construct? Because the other services are, and I'm familiar with your space constraints, not a lot of additional manning possibilities on a ship.
Right. Well, okay. First, the training. When we look at training, and the training I spoke to was very specific to the operators. We've started to have meetings with the academic folks, including the dean from the Naval Academy, about how do you just can't train the people that are going to go off and do this as an MOS. Okay, so how do you train the general populace, both officer enlisted, GS, and contractors, in basic, here's what a network is, here's how it functions, basically. Not the, everybody thinks I want to train a bunch of computer scientists. No, I don't want them. I want some of them. But just general, how important are networks, how do networks function with the basic pieces, servers, switches, routers, interfaces with human beings, and 85% solution to security. Because if they're on your network, I don't care what kind of suit they wear to work, they're an access point. So if you don't train them in basic network operations, you don't get that 85%. How are we going to do that? I'm working with some other folks to try to figure that out. I don't know right now. We do our annual Internet Assurance or Information Assurance training. I don't think it covers it to the depth that needs to be covered. So I think that was question one.
More to the point, in Army at least, I know in our NOSCs, for instance, the majority of the people, because most of our military personnel are deployed, the NOSCs are mostly employing either contractors or civilians who are not in the military environment, who we train the military to a specific level, but we don't necessarily focus on the civilians to that same training level.
I can't sit up here and answer that for you today. I tell you, we have to do that. I'll say that. Maybe somebody knows better than I do, but if we're not doing that, we have to do it. Because the operators won't be proficient. They won't know what they're doing, so your quality of service is going to go down. That's a huge issue. And if they're not doing it, security piece of it, right, that opens up a whole nother box for you. So let me get back to you on that, and I'll get you actually what we're doing. As far as the MOS is, right now in this business, I'll just give you two examples. We have, or three examples. We have cryptologists that are 1610 coded officers. We have intelligence specialists that are 1630 coded officers, and then information professionals that are 1600 coded officers. We're going to bring all of these folks, the ITs, the IPs, the IWs, all of them, into an MOS or designator that we call an 1800 series designator. So we are going to do that. Now, as far as getting more people, we have what we have on ships. It's a confined space. You can't sort of stuff any more of them in there. But the bigger problem the services have is with overall top line and people. The Navy is 328,800 people in the active component. And then we have 4,400 people that are funded by Overseas Contingency Operations Fund that we wouldn't have on our books if we weren't engaged in the support we're engaged at, engaged in the desert. So given that number of people, 33,200 or whatever the arithmetic works out, how do you reallocate people within that top line of people to get more people into this business? And I'll tell you, the Navy wanted to add 1,000 people to cyber in the 11 budget. There was another organization that came in and wanted a similar number of folks, 1,062 to be exact, and I'll let you figure out who that was. And now all of a sudden, okay, we had generated 1,000 people in some ship decommissions that we did to keep them under the overall top number, but now we couldn't put those folks in at all in cyber because we had to put them somewhere else. And it's so how do you prioritize with given your overall manning constraints to be able to fulfill the needs you have in the across the force? And it's a challenge for all of us. You know, I'll tell you the Navy's manpower bill was going up about 1% a year when we were taking 12,000 people out of the active component every year. And we're down to flatline, so what's that tell me? About 8.5% increase in the cost of people every year. And your top line's not going up at 8.5%, so huge problem for all of us. So, sir?
Kellerman, Core Security. I have a question about measurement and prioritization. Are you increasing the level of red teaming, penetration testing, kind of ethical hacking of your systems? And if so, are the people that are doing it the same people that have been doing it for years, or using the expertise from Fort Meade or other government agencies, and or are you retraining those folks with the Certified Ethical Hacker certification just came out, or using things like the CAG or the 20 critical controls right. as baselines for such assessments?
I'll get you the details on that. We do use red teams. They are periodically updated with folks that are not the same folks that have been here for forever. And what I'll try to do is get you an answer on how do we make sure that they're doing the things they ought to be doing instead of just the stuff they've always been doing. I think's your question. But I'll get back to you on that. And that's a question I have too right now, and I just haven't had it answered yet. But thanks for the question.
I think we have two more questions. Certainly three, I see.
All right, whatever.
Do you have time?
Yeah, I'm good. I think I'm standing between you all and a cocktail. I don't know what I'm saying.
Yeah, Barry, John Cotton, DRS sure. Technologies. Just a real easy one for you, softball here at the end. We've been talking about afloat and ashore
right.
Nets. You have an addressed power grid. As you travel around the world and start talking about clean power for all the things you're going to build, have you been looking at the bill for this and a follow-on? Navy's leading the way with the green power initiatives. Are you looking into this now for what you've got to do?
First, the power consumption for this capability is huge. And, you know, when I first got briefed on what the U.S. Cyber Command headquarters might need for power, I just sort of went, ah. Because I know a Nimitz-class aircraft carrier for ship service distribution has about 32 megawatts of power, and it was more than that. So that was hard for me to get my arms around. So there's that and what the cost of that is. And I'll tell you, it's not – I mean, we run off of commercial power. But it's then what do you have to have on ups and what's the emergency power generation to bring it back, and do you need 100% of your capacity or which piece of it? So we're working through that. So it's a thought when we go – it's thought about as we go through it. And, I mean, that's one of the things that was done we think about it. The green power we've tried to implement in a lot of our shore installations. We use geothermal out west, and we're looking at, as you know, biofuels for at Super Hornet. We've looked at what we can do with the ships, but in that most of our power is generated commercially. I don't know that we've specifically looked at it outside of the things I said for the shore infrastructure where we have buildings that we heat and cool. But Secretary Mabus says it's one of his highest priorities. And so if we're running something on a Navy base that's consuming electric power, we ought to be looking at it, how to get at it from a green standpoint because of where the Secretary and the service is on that. Is that all right?
Hi, Jeff Abramson with the Arms Control Association. This is a question on a different area. But we've been wrapping our head around whether arms control even makes sense in this cyber realm. And Jim has been helping us think about this a little bit. But I was intrigued by your questions around how do we understand what even the collateral damage is if we do a sort of a cyber attack type capability. And I wonder how you wrap your head around that. Is it at this point just sort of figuring out what they might be, or is there some sort of guidance around it? And then secondly, obviously, this is an issue not just for the U.S. military, but for other militaries.
Right.
And whether there's any cooperation or norm setting that might be possible out there to sort of what's normal, and then when I see this, I know this is a what. This is something that deserves this type of response, or this is this type. So some of that thinking. Thanks.
It's a huge concern to the U.S. government at large. I got to be careful of the examples I use because, to be honest with you, I go inside, in and out of a classified environment so much that, but, you know, okay, and it's like I said, if you were going to generate an attack in country X and you had to go through a router box in country Y, and then you found out that really the only way you could generate the effects was to melt the router box, and I'll use melt by disable the router box in country Y, and then you find out country Z, who's a very good ally of yours, has all our financials going through that router box. And are you willing to accept that level of collateral damage? And so we're going to have to partner with our friends and allies and try to work through this. And as you can imagine, a lot of this is just people don't want you to know where their stuff goes. I've had several conferences and meetings with partner and allied nations to talk about this, and there's a lot of interest in all the militaries, at least the ones we deal with on a pretty regular basis. And there's a lot of concern about people talking about computer network attack and what that means. So if a guy's in your network and he doesn't belong there and he's exfilling your data, you throwing him out of your network or blocking his access is one level of activity. To go into his nation and take that capability away from him may be another. And we need to collectively work together and define those things. You know, I'd say that if you get in somebody's router box or in their box for an exploit, even if you're in there for 400 milliseconds, does that mean it's an attack? And how do you look at that, you know? You could fight the next war. Wham, bam, okay, that war lasted a minute and a half or a second and a half. We can take the rest of the day off. There's huge implications across the various title authorities in the government and who's responsible for what type of actions given those title authorities. And then are you really going to generate what you thought, or are you going to generate something that's totally unacceptable? And so, you know, this is something we've all been working on pretty hard, and there was some folks working on it a long time before I showed up here. So it's something we're very conscious of. We just don't have the answer to it.
Yeah. Well, with that, why don't we close it out? This has been a fabulous presentation.
Thanks a lot for y'all being here. I really appreciate the questions. And you know, this is a huge challenge for not only the U.S. Navy and the U.S. military, but the defense industrial base. It's a huge challenge, and it's the banking industry and the railroad industry and the industry. And so you all are a bunch of smart people that get together here, and we need all the help that you all can generate. Thank you.
Thanks again. Thanks. Good job. You're pretty